Come in, the voice said. The curtain was pulled aside. Reluctantly, Dagosta followed Pendergast into the chamber beyond. The interior was dark, lit only by the reflected glow of the naked bulb outside and by a small fire that smoldered beneath a vent in one corner. In front of them, a man sat in a massive, throne-like chair that had been placed in the exact center of the room. He was tall, with large limbs and long, thick, gray hair. The man was dressed in an ancient, bell-bottom suit of tan corduroy and wore a threadbare Borsellino hat. A heavy, silver Navajo squash-blossom necklace set with turquoise hung around his neck. Mephisto stared at them with unusually penetrating eyes. Mayor Whitey. Unoriginal, not likely to induce reverence, but in your albinoid case, appropriate. The hiss had taken on a slow, formal tone. Dagosta felt the gaze turn on him. Whatever else this guy is, he ain't crazy. At least, not completely crazy. He felt uneasy. Mephisto's eyes glittered with suspicion. And this one? He asked. Cigar, my runner. Mephisto stared at Dagosta for a long time. Then he turned back to Pendergast. I've never heard of a Grant's Tomb community, he said, voice laced with doubt. There's a large network of service tunnels beneath Columbia and its outbuildings, Pendergast said. We're small, and we mind our own business. Students are pretty generous. Mephisto nodded, listening. The look of suspicion slowly vanished, replaced by something that was either a leer or a smile. Dagosta couldn't be sure which. Of course. Always nice to meet an ally in these dark days. Let's seal this meeting with some refreshment. We can talk afterwards. He clapped his hands. Cheers for our guests, and get that fire going. Tailgunner, bring us some meat. A thin, short man Dagosta had not seen before appeared out of the shadows and left the caboose. Another, who had been sitting cross-legged on the floor, struggled to his feet and, moving with glacial slowness, piled wood on the fire and poked it into life.
It's already too damn hot in here, Dagosta thought as he felt the sweat trickle down the inside of his greasy shirt.
An enormous, heavily muscled man came in with two packing crates, which he set in front of Mephisto's chair.
Gentlemen, please, Mephisto said with mock gravity, gesturing at the crates.
Dagosta settled himself gingerly on the packing crate as the man called Tailgunner returned, carrying something wet and dripping in a piece of old newspaper. He dropped it beside the fire, and Dagosta felt his stomach seize up involuntarily. Inside was an enormous rat, its head half-crushed, paws still twitching rhythmically as if to some internal beat.
Excellent! Cried Mephisto. Fresh caught, as you can see.
He turned his piercing eyes on Pendergast.
You do eat track rabbit, don't you?
Of course, Pendergast replied.
Dagosta noticed that the heavily muscled man was now standing directly behind them. It began to dawn on him that they were about to undergo a test they had better not fail. Reaching out, Mephisto took the carcass in one hand and a long metal roasting spit in the other. Holding the rat beneath its front haunches, Mephisto deftly threaded the skewer from anus to head, then set it over the fire to roast. Dagosta watched in horrified fascination as the hair immediately sizzled and caught fire, and the rat gave one final convulsive spasm. A moment later, the entire animal flared up, sending a plume of acrid smoke toward the roof of the caboose. It died down again, the tail withering into a blackened corkscrew. Mephisto watched the rat for a moment, then he plucked it from the fire, pulled a knife out of his coat, and scraped the remaining hair off the skin. Piercing the belly to release the cooking gases, he returned it to the flame, this time at a higher elevation.
It takes skill, he said, to cook le grand cerf en brochette.
Dagosta waited, acutely aware that all eyes were on him and Pendergast. He did not want to imagine what would happen if he betrayed the slightest hint of disgust. Minutes passed in silence as the rat sizzled. Mephisto rotated the rack, then looked at Pendergast.
"How do you like yours?" he asked.
"I prefer mine rare."
"Suits me," Pendergast said, as placidly as if he were being offered toast points at Tavern on the Green.
"It's just an animal,"
Dagosta thought in desperation.
"Eating it won't kill me, which is more than I can say for these guys."
Mephisto sighed in ill-concealed anticipation.
"Look done to you?"
"Let's eat,"
said Pendergast, rubbing his hands together. Dagosta said nothing.
"This calls for alcohol,"
cried Mephisto. Almost immediately, a half-empty bottle of nitrate appeared. Mephisto eyed it with disgust.
"These are my guests," he said, tossing the bottle aside. "Bring something suitable."
Shortly, a mossy bottle of cold duck and 3 plastic glasses arrived. Mephisto removed the metal skewer and slid the cooked rat onto the newspaper.
"You do the honors," he said, handing it to Pendergast.
Dagosta struggled with a sudden sense of panic. What was Pendergast supposed to do? He watched with mingled horror and relief as Pendergast, without hesitation, raised the rat and put his lips to the gash in its flank. There was a sharp sucking sound as the rodent was eviscerated. Dagosta felt his gorge rise. Licking his lips, Pendergast set the newspaper and its burden in front of their host.
"Excellent," he said simply.
Mephisto nodded.
"Interesting technique?"
"Hardly," Pendergast shrugged. "They spread a lot of rat poison around the Columbia service tunnels. You can always tell by tasting the liver whether it's safe to eat."
A broad and genuine smile spread across Mephisto's face.
"I'll remember that," he said.
Taking the knife, he cut several strips of meat from one haunch and handed them to Dagosta. The moment had come. Out of the corner of his eye, Dagosta saw the hulking figure behind them grow tense. Squeezing his eyelids closed, he attacked the meat with feigned gusto, stuffing everything into his mouth at once, chewing furiously and swallowing the strips almost before he had a chance to taste them. He grinned through his agony, wrestling with the horrible feeling of nausea that swept across his gut.
"Bravo!" said Mephisto, watching. "A true gourmand!"
The level of tension in the air decreased palpably. As Dagosta sat back on his packing crate, putting a protective hand over his stomach, the silence in the room gave way to low laughter and whispered conversation.
"You'll forgive my suspicion," Mephisto said. "There was a time when life underground was much more open and trusting. If you are who you say you are, you know that already. But these are difficult times."
Mephisto poured them each a glass of wine, then raised his own in a toast. He sliced off several more cuts of meat and passed them to Pendergast, then demolished the rest of the rat himself.
"Let me introduce my lieutenants," Mephisto said.
He waved at the hulking figure that stood behind them.
"This is Little Harry. Got into horse pretty young. Took to petty thievery to support the habit. One thing led to another, and he ended up in Attica. They taught him quite a lot there. When he got out, he couldn't find a job. Luckily, he wandered below and joined our community before he could fall back into bad habits."
Mephisto pointed at the slow-moving figure by the fire.
"That's Boy Alice. Used to teach English at a Connecticut prep school. Things went sour. He lost his job, got divorced, ran out of money, began hitting the bottle. He gravitated to the shelters and soup kitchens. That's where he heard about us. As for Tail Gunner, he got back from Nam only to find that the country he'd defended didn't want anything to do with him."
Mephisto wiped his mouth on the newspaper.
That's more than you need to know, he said. We've left the past behind, as you must have.
So you hear about the killings?
Pendergast nodded.
3 of our people have been missing since last week, and the rest are getting concerned. We heard your call for alliance against the Wrinklers, the headless killers.
Word is getting around. 2 days ago I heard from the philosopher.
Know of him? Pendergast hesitated for just a second.
No, he replied.
Mephisto's eyes narrowed.
Odd, he said.
He's my counterpart, leader of the communities beneath Grand Central.
Perhaps someday we shall meet, Pendergast said. For now I need to take word back, reassurances for my people. What can you tell me about the killings and the killers?
They started almost a year ago, Mephisto replied in a silky hiss.
First was Joe Atcity. We found his body dumped outside the blockhouse, head gone. Next, Dark Annie disappeared. Then Master Sergeant. It went on and on. Some we found, most we didn't. Later we got word from the Manders that deep activity had been detected.
Pendergast frowned.
Manders?
Again Mephisto shot a suspicious glance toward him.
Never heard of the Manders?
He cackled.
You ought to stretch your legs more. Get out, see the neighborhood, Mayor Whitey. The Manders live below us. Never come up, never use lights like salamanders. Versteht? They said there were signs of movement below them.
His voice dropped to a whisper.
They said the devil's attic had been colonized.
The ghoster looked questioningly at Pendergast, but the FBI agent merely nodded.
The lowest level of the city, he said, as if to himself.
The very lowest,
Mephisto replied.
Have you been down there?
Pendergast asked with deliberate casualness. Mephisto flashed him a look as if to imply even he wasn't that crazy.
But you think these people are behind the killings?
I don't think it. I know it. They're beneath us right now.
Mephisto smiled grimly.
But I'm not sure I'd use the word people.
What do you mean?
Pendergast said, the casualness gone from his voice.
Rumor,
Mephisto said very quietly.
They say they're called Wrinklers for a reason.
Witches?
Mephisto did not answer. Pendergast sat back on his crate.
So, what can we do?
What can we do?
The smile vanished from Mephisto's face. We can wake up this city. That's what we can do. We can show them that it won't just be the mole people, the invisible people who die.
And if we do that?
Pendergast asked. What can the city do about these Wrinklers? Mephisto thought a moment.
Like any infestation, get them where they live.
Easier said than done.
Mephisto's hard, glittery gaze landed on the FBI agent.
You got a better idea, Whitey? He hissed.
Pendergast was silent.
Not yet, he said at last.
24. Robert Wilson, librarian at the New York Historical Society, looked at the other occupant of the map room with irritation. Odd-looking guy, somber black suit, pale cat's eyes, blonde white hair combed severely back from a high forehead. Annoying, too. Annoying as hell. He'd been there all afternoon making demands and throwing the maps askew. Every time Wilson turned back to his computer to resume work on his own pet project, the definitive monograph on Zuni fetishes, the man would be up asking more questions. As if on cue, the man got out of his chair and glided over noiselessly.
Pardon?
He said in his polite but insistent mint julep drawl. Wilson glanced up from the screen.
Yes,
he snapped.
I hate to trouble you again, but it's my understanding that the Vole and Olmsted plans for Central Park called for canals to drain the Central Park swamps. I wonder if I could look at those plans?
Wilson compressed his lips. Those plans were rejected by the Parks Commission, he replied. They've been lost.
A tragedy.
He turned back to his screen, hoping the man would take the hint. The real tragedy would be if he didn't get back to his monograph.
I see,
the visitor said, not taking the hint at all.
Then tell me, how were the swamps drained?
Wilson sat back in his chair exasperatedly.
I should have thought it was common knowledge. The old 86th Street aqueduct was used.
And there are plans for this operation?
Yes, said Wilson.
May I see them?
With a sigh, Wilson got up and made his way through the heavy door back into the stacks. It was, of course, in its usual mess. The room managed to be both vast and claustrophobic, metal shelves reaching 2 stories into the gloom, tottering with rolled maps and moldering blueprints. Wilson could almost feel the dust settling on his bald scalp as he scanned the arcane lists of numbers. His nose began to itch. He found the correct location, pulled the ancient maps, and carried them back to the cramped reading room.
Why do people always request the heaviest maps?
He wondered to himself as he emerged from the stacks.
Here they are,
Wilson said, placing them on the mahogany counter. He watched as the man took them over to his desk and began looking them over, jotting notes and making sketches in a small, leather-bound notebook.
He's got money, Wilson thought sourly. No professor could afford a suit like that.
A heavenly quiet descended on the map room. At last he could get some work done. Bringing some yellowed reference photographs out of his desk, Wilson began making changes to his chapter on clan imagery. Within minutes, he felt the visitor standing behind him again. Wilson looked up again, silently. The man nodded at one of Wilson's photographs. It showed a nondescript stone carved in an abstract representation of an animal, a small piece of sinew holding a flint point to its back.
I think you'll find that particular fetish, which I see you've labeled as a puma, is in fact a grizzly bear, the man said.
Wilson looked at the pale face and the faint smile, wondering if this was some kind of a joke. Cushing, who collected this fetish in 1883, specifically identified it as Puma Clan, he replied. You can check the reference yourself.
Everybody was an expert these days.
The grizzly fetish, the man continued, undeterred, always has a spear point strapped to its back, as this one does. The puma fetish has an arrowhead.
Wilson straightened up.
Just what is the difference, may I ask?
You kill a puma with a bow and arrow. To kill a grizzly, you must use a spear.
Wilson was silent.
Cushing was wrong on occasion, the man added gently.
Wilson shuffled his manuscript together and laid it aside.
Frankly, I would prefer to trust Cushing over someone...
He left the sentence unfinished. The library will be closing in 1 hour, he added.
In that case, the man said, I wonder if I could see the plates from the 1956 Upper West Side Natural Gas Pipeline Survey.
Wilson compressed his lips.
Which ones?
All of them, if you please.
This was too much.
I'm sorry, Wilson said crisply. It's against the rules. Patrons are allowed only 10 maps at a time from the same series.
He glared at the visitor triumphantly. But the man seemed oblivious, lost in thought. Suddenly he looked back at the librarian.
"Robert Wilson," he said, pointing at the nameplate. "Now I remember why your name is familiar."
"You do?"
Wilson asked uncertainly.
"Indeed. Aren't you the one who gave the excellent paper on mirage stones at the Navajo Studies Conference in Window Rock last year?"
"Why, yes, I did," Wilson said.
"I thought so. I wasn't able to be there myself, but I read the proceedings. I've made something of a private study of Southwestern religious imagery."
The visitor paused.
"Nothing as serious as yours, of course."
Wilson cleared his throat.
I suppose one cannot spend 30 years in such study, he said as modestly as possible, without one's name becoming known.
The visitor smiled. It's an honor to make your acquaintance. My name is Pendergast. Wilson extended his hand and encountered an unpleasantly limp handshake. He prided himself on the firmness of his own. It's gratifying to see you continue in your studies, the man named Pendergast said. Ignorance of Southwestern culture is so profound.
It is, Wilson agreed wholeheartedly. He felt a peculiar sense of pride. Nobody had taken the least interest in his work before, let alone been able to talk about it intelligibly. Of course, this Pendergast was obviously misinformed about Indian fetishes, but
I'd love to discuss this further, Pendergast said. But I fear I've taken up enough of your time.
Well, not at all, Wilson replied. What was that you'd asked to see, the 56 survey?
Pendergast nodded. There was one other item, if I may. I understand there was a survey of existing tunnels done in the 1920s for the proposed interborough rapid transit system. Is that correct?
Wilson's face fell.
But there are 60 maps in that series.
His voice trailed off.
I see, Pendergast said. It's against the rules, then.
He looked crestfallen. Suddenly, Wilson smiled.
I won't tell if you won't, he said,
pleased at his own recklessness.
And don't worry about closing time. I'll be here late working on my monograph. Rules were made to be broken, right?
10 minutes later, he emerged from the gloom of the storage room, pushing an overloaded cart across the worn floorboards. 25. Smithback walked into the cavernous entryway of the Four Seasons, eager to leave the heat and stench and noise of Park Avenue behind. He approached the four-square bar with measured step. He'd sat here many times before, looking enviously across the room, past the Picasso hanging, toward the unattainable paradise beyond. This time, however, he did not dally at the bar, but continued toward the maitre d'. A quickly mentioned name was all it took, and now he, Smithback, was himself walking down that corridor of dreams toward the exclusive restaurant beyond. Every table in the pool room was filled, yet the space seemed quiet and calm somehow, muted by its own vastness. He threaded his way past captains of industry, publishing moguls, and robber barons to one of the prized tables near the fountain. There, already seated, was Mrs. Wisher.
"Mr. Smithback," she said, "thank you for coming. Please sit down."
Smithback took the indicated chair across the table, glancing about as he did so. This promised to be an interesting lunch, and he hoped he had time to enjoy it fully. He'd barely started to write up his big story, and press time was 6 p.m.
"Would you care for a glass of Amarone?" Mrs. Wisher asked, indicating the bottle beside the table.
She was crisply dressed in a saffron-colored blouse and pleated skirt.
"Please,"
Smithback replied, meeting her gaze. He felt much more at ease than the last time he'd spoken to her, sitting primly in her darkened apartment, a copy of the Post lying beside her like a silent accusation. His Angel of Central Park South obituary, the Post's reward offer, and his favorable coverage on the Grand Army Plaza rally made him feel confident of a warmer reception. Mrs. Wisher nodded to the wine steward, waited until the man had poured a glass for the journalist and departed, then leaned almost imperceptibly forward.
"Mr. Smithback, you're undoubtedly wondering why I asked you to join me for lunch."
"It had occurred to me," Smithback tasted the wine, found it excellent.
"I won't waste any time sporting with your intelligence, then. Certain events are about to happen in this city, and I'd like you to document them."
Smithback put his wine glass down.
"Me."
The corners of Mrs. Wisher's mouth turned up slightly in what might have been a smile.
"Ah, I thought you would be surprised. But you see, Mr. Smithback, I've done some research on you since our last meeting, and I read your book on the museum murders."
You bought a copy? Smithback asked hopefully.
"The Amsterdam Avenue branch of the public library had one. It made very interesting reading. I had no idea you were so directly involved with almost every aspect of that event."
Smithback's eyes darted quickly toward her face, but he could detect no trace of sarcasm in her expression.
"I also read your article on our rally," Mrs. Wisher continued. "It had a positive tone that I found lacking in some of the other press coverage."
She waved her hand.
"Besides, I really have you to thank for what's happened."
"You do?"
Smithback asked a little nervously. Mrs. Wisher nodded.
It was you who convinced me that the only way to get the city's attention was to dig a spur into its flank. Remember your comment? People in this town don't pay attention to something unless you slap them in the face with it. Had it not been for you, I might still be in my drawing room writing letters to the mayor instead of putting my sorrow to good use.
Smithback nodded. The not-so-merry widow had a point.
Since that rally, our movement has spread dramatically, Mrs. Wisher said. We've hit a common nerve. People are coming together, people of power and influence. But our message belongs just as much to the common man, the man on the street, and that's the person you can reach with your paper.
Although Smithback did not like to be reminded that he wrote for the common man, he kept his expression even. Besides, he'd seen it for himself. By the time the rally had ended, there had been plenty of them around, drinking, heckling, hoping for action.
And so this is what I propose.
Mrs. Wisher placed her small, neatly manicured fingernails on the linen tablecloth.
I will give you privileged access to every event planned by Take Back Our City. Many of these actions will be intentionally unannounced. The press, like the police, will learn of them too late to make any real difference. You, however, will be brought into my circle. You will know what to expect and when to expect it. You can accompany me directly, if you like, and then you can slap your readers in the face with it.
Smithback struggled to keep from betraying his excitement.
This is too good to be true, he thought.
I imagine you'd like to publish another book, Mrs. Wisher went on. Once the Take Back Our City campaign reaches a successful conclusion, you'd have my blessing on such a project. I'll make myself available for interviews, and Hiram Bennett, editor-in-chief of Arcadia House, is one of my closest friends. I think he'd be very interested in seeing such a manuscript.
Jesus, Smithback thought. Hiram Bennett? Mr. Publishing himself?
He could imagine the bidding war between Arcadia House and Octavo, the publishers of his museum book. He'd get his agent to set up an auction, specify a floor of 200 grand. Make that 250 with 10% topping privileges, and...
I ask one thing in return,
Mrs. Wisher coolly interrupted his thoughts. That from now on, you devote yourself to covering Take Back Our City. I want your newspaper articles, when they appear, to focus exclusively on our cause.
What?
Smithback said abruptly. Mrs. Wisher, I'm a crime reporter. I'm hired to turn in product on a regular basis. His visions of publishing fame quickly faded, replaced with the angry face of his editor, Arnold Murray, demanding copy. Mrs. Wisher nodded.
I understand. And I think I can deliver you all the product you could wish for within a few days. I'll give you details as soon as we've finalized our plans. Trust me, I think that you will find this relationship to be beneficial to us both.
Smithback thought quickly. In a couple of hours he was due to file his story covering what he'd learned eavesdropping on the museum conference. He'd delayed it already, hoping in vain to gain additional information. This was to be the story that got him his raise, the story to set that prick Bryce Harriman back on his heels. But would it? The reward was getting a little stale, and no leads had panned out. His report on Mephisto hadn't excited the interest he thought it would. There was no clear proof that the death of the medical examiner, though suspiciously coincidental, was connected. And then there were always the unpleasant consequences of museum trespass to be considered. But this Wisher story, on the other hand, could be just the dynamite he was looking for. His journalist's instincts told him it had the feel of a winner. He could call in sick, stall Murray for a day or two. When he got the final results, all would be forgiven. He looked up.
Mrs. Wisher, you've got yourself a deal.
Call me Annette,
she said, her gaze drifting over his face for a moment before falling toward the menu at her elbow.
And now let's order, shall we? I'd suggest the cold water scallops wrapped in lemon phyllo and caviar. The chef here does them excellently.
26. Hayward rounded the corner onto 72nd Street, then stopped, frowning in disbelief at the sand-colored building that loomed up in front of her. She checked her pocket for the scribbled address, then stared up again. There was no mistake. But the place looked more like a mansion out of a Charles Adams cartoon, magnified perhaps 20 times, than a Manhattan apartment building. The structure rose, stone upon layer of stone, 9 generous stories into the air. Near its top, huge 2-story gables hung like eyebrows over the facade. The copper-trimmed slate roof above was encrusted with chimneys, spires, turrets, finials, everything but a widow's walk.
Or maybe arrow slits would be more appropriate, Hayward thought.
The Dakota, it was called. Strange name for a strange-looking place. She'd heard of the place, but had never seen it. Then again, she didn't get many excuses to visit the Upper West Side. She walked toward the arched carriageway that bored into the southern flank of the building. The guard inside the adjoining sentry box took her name, then made a brief call. "Southwest lobby, 5th floor," he said, hanging up and directing her through. She stepped past him toward the dark tunnel. On the far side, the archway opened into a large interior courtyard. Hayward stopped for a moment, staring at the bronze fountains, thinking that the genteel, almost secretive hush seemed absurdly out of place on the west side of Manhattan. Then she turned right and headed for the nearest corner of the courtyard. She stepped through the narrow lobby and into the elevator, stabbing the button marked 5 with a slender finger. The elevator rose slowly, opening at last into a small rectangular space. Stepping out, she saw that on the far side, a single door had been set into the dark, polished wood. The elevator whispered shut and began to descend, leaving Hayward in blackness. For a moment, she wondered if she was on the wrong floor. There was a slight rustle, and her right hand moved instinctively toward her service piece.
"Sergeant Hayward. Excellent. Please come in."
Even in the dark, Hayward would have recognized the accent, the bourbon and buttermilk voice. But the far door had opened, and Agent Pendergast was standing just within, his slim, unmistakable figure silhouetted by the soft light of the room beyond. Hayward stepped inside, and Pendergast shut the door behind her. Though the room was not especially large, its high ceiling gave it a sense of formal grandeur. Hayward looked around curiously. 3 of the walls were painted a deep rose, edged above and below in black molding. Light came from behind what appeared to be wafer-thin pieces of agate, framed in scallop-shaped bronze fixtures set well above eye level. The 4th wall was covered in black marble. Across the entire face of the marble, a thin sheet of water fell like a stream of glass from ceiling to floor, gurgling silently into the grill that ran along its base. A few small leather sofas were placed about the room, their bases hidden by the thick nap of the carpet. The only decoration consisted of a few paintings and several twisted plants scattered here and there on lacquer tables. The room was fastidiously clean, without a smudge or a particle of dust. Though she knew there must be other doors leading into the interior of the apartment, their outlines were too well concealed for her to make them out.
"Sit anywhere, Miss Hayward," Pendergast said. "May I offer you a refreshment of some kind?"
"No, thanks," Hayward replied,
selecting the seat closest to the door and letting the soft black leather creep luxuriously up around her. She stared at the painting on the nearest wall, an impressionist landscape of haystacks and pink-tinged sunlight that seemed somehow familiar.
"Nice place, though the building's kind of weird."
"We tenants would prefer to call it eccentric," Pendergast said. "But many would have agreed with you over the years, I suppose. The Dakota, so named because when it was built in 1884, this part of town seemed as remote as Indian territory. Still, it has a solidity, a kind of permanence that I like. Built on bedrock, walls almost 30 inches thick at ground level. But you didn't come here to listen to a lecture on architecture. Actually, I'm grateful you came at all."
"You kidding?" Hayward asked, "and pass up a chance to tour Agent Pendergast's crib? You're kind of a legend among the rank and file these days, as if you didn't know."
"How reassuring," Pendergast replied, slipping into a chair. "But this is the extent of the tour, I'm afraid. I rarely entertain visitors. Still, it seemed the best place for our chat."
"And why is that?" Hayward asked as she looked around. Then her eyes lighted on the closest of the lacquered tables. "Hey," she pointed, "that's a bonsai plant, a miniature tree. My sensei at the karate dojo has a couple of them."
"Ginkgo biloba," Pendergast said, "the maiden hair.
It's the only remaining member of a tree family common in prehistory. And to your right is a group planting of dwarf trident maples. I'm especially proud of their natural look. The trees in that planting all change color at different times in the fall. From the first tree to the last, that construction took me 9 years. Your sensei could no doubt tell you that the secret to group plantings is to add bonsai in odd numbers at a time, up to a point where counting the trunks demands concentration. Then you're done.
9 years? Hayward repeated. Guess you've got a lot of free time on your hands.
Not really. Bonsai is one of my passions. It is an art that is never finished, and I find its blend of natural and artificial aesthetics intoxicating.
He crossed one leg over the other, his black-suited form almost invisible against the dark leather, and waved one hand dismissively.
But stop encouraging me. A moment ago, you asked why I thought this the best place to talk. It's because I wish to learn more about the underground homeless.
Hayward was silent.
You've worked with them, Pendergast continued. You've studied them. You are an expert on the subject.
Nobody else thinks so.
If they gave the matter any thought, they would. In any case, I can understand why you're sensitive about your dissertation, and it seemed to me you might be more comfortable discussing it off-duty, someplace far away from headquarters or the station house.
The man had a point, Hayward thought. This strange, soothing room with its quiet waterfall and stark beauty seemed about as far from headquarters as the moon. Sitting back in the intoxicating softness of the chair, she felt her natural wariness draining away. She thought about taking off her bulky gun belt, but decided she was too comfortable to move.
"I've been down twice," Pendergast said. "The first time merely to test my disguise and do some simple reconnaissance, and the second time to find Mephisto, the homeless leader. But when I found him, I discovered I'd underestimated a couple of things. The depth of his convictions, and the size of his following."
"Nobody knows exactly how many live below ground," Hayward said. "The only thing you can be sure of is the number's bigger than you expect. As for Mephisto, he's probably the most famous mayor down there. His community's the biggest. Actually, I heard it's several communities. A core community of troubled Vietnam vets and 60s relics, with others joining after the headless murders started. The deeper tunnels below Central Park are crawling with him and his pals."
"What surprised me was the variety I encountered," Pendergast went on. "I expected to find one flawed personality type predominating, perhaps two, but instead I found an entire cross-section of humanity."
"Not all homeless go below," Hayward said, "but the ones afraid of the shelters, the ones that hate the soup kitchens and subway gratings, the loners, the cult freaks, they tend to go down, first to the subway tunnels, then farther. Believe me, there's lots of places to hide."
Pendergast nodded. "Even on my first trip, I was astonished at the vastness. I felt like Lewis and Clark setting out to explore unmapped territory."
"You don't know the half of it. There's 2,000 miles of abandoned or half-dug tunnels, and another 5,000 miles still in use. Underground chambers, sealed up and forgotten."
Hayward shrugged.
"And you hear stories, like about bomb shelters secretly built by the Pentagon in the '50s to protect Wall Street types. Some of them are still stocked with running water, electricity, canned food. Engine rooms filled with abandoned machinery, ancient sewers made from wooden pipes, an entire freaking lost world."
Pendergast sat forward in his chair.
"Sergeant Hayward," he said quietly, "have you heard of the Devil's Attic?"
Hayward nodded.
"Yeah, I've heard of it."
"Can you tell me where it is, or how I can locate it?"
There was a long silence while she thought.
"No. One or two of the homeless mentioned it during rousts, but you hear so much crap down there you tune most of it out. I always thought it was bullshit."
"Is there anybody I can talk to who might know more?"
Hayward shifted slightly.
"You might talk to Al Diamond," she said, her eyes drifting again toward the picture of the haystacks. Amazing, she thought, how a couple of thick dabs of paint could capture an image so clearly. "He's an engineer for the PA, a real authority on underground structures.
They always call him in when a deep main breaks or when a new gas tunnel has to be bored. She paused.
Haven't seen him around for a while, though. Maybe he bought the farm.
Excuse me?
Died, I mean.
There was a silence, broken only by the soft hush of the waterfall. If the killers have colonized some secret space underground, the sheer number of homeless will make our own job extremely difficult, Pendergast said at last. Hayward took her eyes from the picture of the haystack and fastened them on the FBI agent.
It gets worse, she said.
What do you mean? Autumn's only a few weeks away. That's when the homeless really start streaming underground, anticipating winter. If you're right about these killers, you know what that means.
No, I don't, Pendergast said.
Why don't you tell me?
Hunting season,
Hayward said, and shifted her gaze back to the painting. 27. The length of grimy industrial avenue ended in an embankment of riprap, half-tumbling into the murky depths of the East River. Beyond lay a panoramic view of Roosevelt Island and the 59th Street Bridge. Across the river, the thin gray strip of the FDR Drive wound its way up past the United Nations and the luxurious Sutton Place co-ops.
Nice view, thought DaGosta as he stepped out of the unmarked cruiser. Nice view, lousy neighborhood.
The August sun slanted into the avenue, softening the puddles of tar and coaxing waves of shimmering heat from the pavement. Loosening his collar, DaGosta once again checked the address the museum personnel office had given him. 1146 34th Avenue, Long Island City. He glanced at the nearby buildings, wondering if there was some mistake. This sure as hell didn't look like a residential neighborhood. The street was lined with old warehouses and abandoned factories. Even though it was noon, the place was almost deserted, the only sign of life a shabby panel truck pulling out of a loading bay at the far end of the block. DaGosta shook his head.
Another friggin' dead end.
Leave it to Waxy to saddle him with what, in Waxy's opinion, was the assignment of lowest priority. The door to 1146 was of thick metal, dented and scarred, and covered in perhaps 10 coats of black paint. Like everything else on the block, it looked like the entrance to an empty warehouse. DaGosta rang the ancient buzzer and then, hearing nothing, pounded heavily on the door. Silence. He waited a few minutes, then ducked into a narrow alley along one side of the building. Making his way through crumbling rolls of tar paper, DaGosta approached a window of wired glass, webbed with cracks and almost opaque with dust. Climbing onto the tar paper, he rubbed a hole clean with his tie and looked in. As his eyes adjusted to the dim interior, he made out a vast, empty space. Faint bars of light striped across the stained cement floor. At the far end was a staircase leading up to what must once have been the office of the line boss. Otherwise, nothing. There was a sudden movement in the alley, and DaGosta turned to see a man coming at him fast, a long kitchen knife shining wickedly in one hand. Reflexively, DaGosta leapt for the ground, pulling his service piece as he did so. The man stared at the gun in surprise, stopping short. He gathered himself to flee.
Halt! DaGosta barked. Police officer!
The man turned back again. Inexplicably, a look of amusement came over his features.
A cop! He cried sarcastically. Fancy that, a cop in these parts!
He continued to stand there, grinning. He was the strangest-looking person DaGosta had ever seen. A shaved head, painted green, a wispy goatee, tiny Trotsky-esque glasses, a shirt made out of something like hairy burlap, ancient red Keds sneakers.
Drop the knife, said DaGosta.
Hey, it's okay, the man said. I thought you were a burglar.
I said drop the damn knife.
The grin disappeared from the man's face. He tossed the knife onto the ground between them. DaGosta kicked it aside.
Now turn around slowly and put your hands on the wall. Spread your feet wide.
What is this, Communist China?
The man objected.
Do it,
DaGosta said. The man obeyed, grumbling, and DaGosta patted him down, finding nothing more than a wallet. He flipped it open. The driver's license showed an address next door. DaGosta holstered his gun and handed the man his wallet.
You know, Mr. Kurtzema, I could have shot you back there.
Hey, but I didn't know you were a cop. I thought you were trying to break in.
The man stepped away from the wall, wiping his hands together.
You don't know how many times I've been robbed. You guys don't even bother to respond anymore. You're the first cop I've seen around here in months, and...
The ghost waved him silent.
Just be more careful. Besides, you don't know squat about handling a knife. If I was a real burglar, you'd probably be dead right now.
The man rubbed his nose, mumbling something incomprehensible.
You live next door? The ghost asked.
He could not get over the fact that this man had painted his entire scalp green. He tried not to stare at it. The man nodded. How long?
About 3 years. I used to have a loft in Soho, but I got evicted. This is the only place I found where I can do my work without being bothered.
And what kind of work is that?
It's hard to explain.
The man grew suddenly guarded.
Why should I tell you?
The ghost dug into his pocket, flashed his badge and ID. The man looked at the badge.
Homicide, eh? Someone murdered around here?
No.
Can we go inside and talk for a moment?
The man looked at him suspiciously.
Is this a search? Aren't you supposed to have a warrant?
The ghost swallowed his annoyance.
It's voluntary. I want to ask you a few questions about the man who lived in this warehouse, Kawakita.
Was that his name?
Now there was a weird guy. Seriously weird.
Leading the ghost out of the alley, the man named Kurtzuma unlocked his own black metal door. Stepping inside, the ghost found himself inside another vast warehouse, painted bone white. Along the walls were a number of oddly shaped metal cans filled with trash. A dead palm tree stood in one corner. In the middle of the room, the ghost could see countless black strings hung from the ceiling in clumps. It felt like some kind of nightmarish moon forest. In the far corner, he could see a cot, sink, exposed toilet, and hot plate. No other amenities were visible.
So what's this? The ghost asked, fingering the strings.
My God, don't tangle them!
Kurtzuma almost knocked the ghost aside in his rush to repair the damage.
They're never supposed to touch,
he said, in a wounded tone as he fussed with the strings. The ghost stepped back.
What is this, some kind of experiment?
No, it's an artificial environment, a reproduction of the primeval jungle that we all evolved in, translated to New York City.
The ghost looked at the strings in disbelief.
So this is art?
Who looks at it?
It's conceptual art,
Kurtzuma explained impatiently.
Nobody looks at it. It's not meant to be seen. It is sufficient that it exists. The strings never touch, just as we human beings never touch, never really interact. We are alone, and this whole world is unseen, just as we float through the cosmos unseen. As Derrida said, art is that which is not art, which means...
Did you know if his first name was Gregory?
Jacques. Jacques Derrida, not Gregory.
I mean the man who lived next door.
Like I said, I didn't even know his name. I avoided him like the plague. Guess you're here because of the complaints.
Complaints?
Yeah. I called again and again. After the first couple of times, nobody came.
He blinked.
No, wait. You're homicide. Did he kill somebody?
Without answering, the ghost took a notebook out of a coat pocket.
Tell me about him.
Well, he moved in 2 years ago, maybe a little less. At first he seemed pretty quiet. Then these trucks began pulling up, and all kinds of boxes and crates started going inside. That's when the noise started. What was it, night? Hammering, thuds, loud popping noises, and the smell!
Kurtzuma wrinkled his nose in disgust.
Like something acrid burning. He painted the inside of the windows black, but one of them got broken somehow, and I got a look inside before it was repaired.
He grinned.
He was a strange-looking setup. I could see microscopes, big glass beakers boiling and boiling, gray metal boxes with lights on them, aquaria.
Aquaria?
One aquarium after another, rows upon rows, big things, full of algae. Obviously he was a scientist of some kind.
Kurtzuma pronounced the word with distaste.
A dissector, a reductionist. I don't like that way of looking at the world. I am a holist, Sergeant.
I see.
Then one day the power company came around, said they had to hook up some special heavy-duty lines to his place or something, and they turned off my power for 2 days. 2 days! But try complaining to Con Ed, dehumanized bureaucrats.
Did he have any visitors? The ghost asked.
Any friends?
Visitors, Kurt Summa snorted.
That was the last straw. People began arriving, always at night. They had this way of knocking, like some kind of signal. That was when I first called the cops. I knew something seriously weird was happening there. I thought maybe it was drugs. The cops came, said there was nothing illegal going on, and left again.
He shook his head bitterly at the memory.
It went on like that. I kept calling the cops, complaining about the noise and the smell, but after the second visit, they wouldn't come anymore. And then one day, maybe a year ago, the guy appeared at my door, just showed up, no warning or anything, about 11 o'clock at night.
What did he want? The ghost asked.
Don't know. I think he wanted to ask me why I'd called the cops on him. All I know is he gave me the willies. It was September, almost as hot as it is now, but he had on a bulky coat with a big hood. He stood back in the shadows, and I couldn't see his face. He just stood there in the darkness and asked if he could come in. I said, no, of course. I mean, Sergeant, it was all I could do not to shut the door in his face.
Lieutenant, corrected the ghost absently, scribbling in his notebook.
Whatever, I don't put stock in labels. Human being is the only label worth anything.
The green dome bobbed in emphasis. The ghost was still scribbling. This didn't sound like the Greg Kawakita he'd met once in Frock's office after the disaster at the Superstition exhibition opening. He racked his brains, trying to remember what he could about the scientist. "Can you describe his voice?" he asked.
"Yes, very low and with a lisp."
The ghost frowned. "Any accent?"
"Don't think so. But it was such a strong lisp, I couldn't really tell. Sounded almost Castilian, you know, except it was English instead of Spanish."
The ghost made a mental note to ask Pendergast what the hell Castilian was. "When did he leave, and why?" he asked.
"A couple of weeks after he knocked on my door. Maybe October. One night I heard two big 18-wheelers pull up. That wasn't so unusual. But this time they were loading stuff out of that place, not into it. When I got up at noon, the place was totally empty. They'd even washed the black paint off the inside of the windows."
"This was at noon?" the ghost asked.
"My normal sleep period is 5 to noon. I am not a slave to the physical rotations of the Earth-Sun-Moon system, Sergeant."
"Did you notice anything on the trucks? A logo, say, or the name of a firm?" Kurtzema went silent, thinking.
"Yes," he said finally. "Scientific Precision Moving."
The ghost looked at the middle-aged man with a green scalp. "You sure?"
"Absolutely."
The ghost believed him. With his looks, the guy wouldn't be worth shit on a witness stand, but he was pretty damn observant, or maybe just nosy. "Anything else you want to add?" he said. The green dome bobbed again.
"Yes. Right after he arrived, all the streetlights went out, and they never seemed to be able to fix them. They're still out. I think he had something to do with that, though I don't know what. I called Con Ed about that, too, but as usual, the faceless corporate robots never did anything. Of course, try forgetting to pay your bill one time, and
thanks for your help, Mr. Kurtzema," the ghost interrupted. "Call if anything else comes to mind." He closed the notebook, stuck it in his pocket, and turned to leave. At the door, he paused. "You said you'd been robbed several times. What did they take? There doesn't seem to be much worth lifting in here." He glanced around the warehouse again.
"Ideas, Sergeant,"
Kurtzema said, head back, chin raised.
"Material objects mean nothing, but ideas are priceless. Look around you. Have you ever seen so many brilliant ideas?"
28. Vent stack 12 rose like a nightmare chimney above the 38th Street entrance to the Lincoln Tunnel, a 200-foot spire of brick and rusting metal. Near the top of the enormous stack, a small metal observation chamber clung, barnacle-like, to the side of the orange wall. From his vantage point on the narrow access ladder,
Pendergast could make out the chamber far above his head. The ladder had been bolted to the riverside of the vent stack, and in several places the bolts had pulled free of their moorings. As he climbed, he could see the traffic through the corrugations in the iron steps, wrestling its way into the tunnel 30 yards beneath his feet. The ladder fell into shadow as he approached the underside of the observation chamber. Looking up, Pendergast noticed a hatch set into the chamber's underside. It had a circular handle, like the watertight door of a submarine, and the words, Port of New York Authority, had been stamped into it. The roar of the vent stack was like the shriek of a jet engine, and Pendergast had to bang several times on the hatch before it was raised by the person inside. Pendergast climbed into the tiny metal room and straightened his suit while the occupant, a small, wiry man dressed in a plaid shirt and coveralls, closed the hatch. Three sides of the observation chamber looked down over the Hudson, the approaches to the Lincoln Tunnel, and the massive power plant that sucked foul air out of the tunnel and channeled it up the vent stacks. Craning his neck, Pendergast could make out the spinning turbines of the tunnel's filtration system, rumbling directly beneath them. The man stepped away from the hatch and moved to a stool behind a small draftsman table. There was no other chair in the tiny, cramped chamber. Pendergast watched as the man looked at him and moved his mouth as if speaking, but no sound was audible over the shriek of the huge stack vent beside them.
"What?"
Pendergast shouted, moving closer. The floor hatch did little to keep out either the noise or the traffic fumes wafting up from below.
"ID,"
the man replied.
"They said you'd have some ID."
Pendergast reached into his jacket pocket and showed his FBI identification to the man, who examined it carefully.
"Mr. Albert Diamond, correct?"
Pendergast said.
"Al,"
the man said with a careless gesture.
"What you need?" "I hear you're the authority on underground New York,"
Pendergast said.
"You're the engineer who's consulted on everything from the building of a new subway tunnel to the repair of a gas main."
Diamond stared at Pendergast. One cheek began to bulge as his tongue made a slow traverse of his lower molars.
"Guess that's true,"
he replied at last.
"When were you last underground?"
Diamond raised one fist, opened it wide once, twice, closed it again.
10?
Pendergast said.
10 months?
Diamond shook his head.
"Years?"
Diamond nodded.
"Why so long?" "Got tired. Requested this instead." "Requested? Interesting choice of assignment. About as far away from the underground as one could get without actually being airborne. Intentional?"
Diamond shrugged, neither agreeing or contradicting.
"I need some information,"
Pendergast shouted. It was simply too loud in the observation chamber for any kind of small talk. Diamond nodded, the bulge in his cheek slowly rising as the investigation moved to the upper molars.
"Tell me about the Devil's Attic."
The bulge froze in position. After a few moments, Diamond shifted on the stool, but said nothing. Pendergast continued.
"I'm told there's a level of tunnels underneath Central Park, unusually deep tunnels. I've heard the region referred to as the Devil's Attic, but there are no records of such a place in existence, at least by that name."
After a long moment, Diamond looked down.
"Devil's Attic,"
he repeated, as if with great reluctance.
"Do you know of such a place?"
Diamond reached into his coveralls and drew out a small flask of something that was not water. He took a long pull, then returned the flask without offering it to Pendergast. He said something that was inaudible over the shriek of the exhaust stack.
"What?"
Pendergast cried, moving still closer.
"I said, yeah, I know of it. Tell me about it, please."
Diamond looked away from Pendergast, his eyes grazing over the river toward the New Jersey shore.
"Those rich bastards,"
he said.
"I'm sorry?" "Those rich bastards. Didn't want to rub shoulders with the working class." "Rich bastards?"
Pendergast asked.
"You know, Astor, Rockefeller, Morgan, and the rest. Built those tunnels over a century ago." "I don't understand." "Railroad tunnels,"
Diamond burst out irritably.
"They were building a private rail car line. Came down from Pelham under the park, beneath the Knickerbocker Hotel. The Fifth Avenue parkfront mansions, fancy private stations and waiting rooms, the whole nine yards. But why so deep?
For the first time, Diamond grinned.
Geology. Had to go deeper than the existing train lines and